Hello?
Hi, is this, can I speak with Jason? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah, who's this?
This is James, how's it going?
Oh, geez, wow.
It's been a while.
I think it's been since August.
Yeah, wow. For sure. So we're back. Jason, I'm thrilled, this is great. We took a nice little summer break, you got crazy busy, I got crazy busy, we've been doing a ton of stuff for the last kind of 6 to 8 weeks, but now fall is back, it's kind of time to maybe spend a little bit more time in the office. And with that, TGN's back, and we have kind of a big announcement in kind of considering the future of the show and how we'd keep it running and kind of blending mixed schedules and making sure that everybody's happy with the setup. We've partnered with Hodinkee, and we're now officially brought to you by the site. It's a new partnership and something that we're super excited about. So the great team at Hodinkee, which of course Jason and I work very closely with, we're interested in bringing TGN on as kind of an advertising partner. And moving forward, we couldn't be happier about it. And the only real change that you're going to see or hear for the show is we're going to move to Thursdays, which is a better fit for the overall schedule. So we used to be every other Tuesday. We're now going to be every other Thursday. And we'll stick to that like we have up until our summer break. And then we're also going to have the occasional ad on the show. Currently, we don't have any ads, but when it comes up, we'll make sure that it's super obvious. If you've listened to the fantastic Hodinkee Radio episodes, the ads are going to be very similar in kind of style and setup to that. So,
yeah, I'm excited. I think this really dovetails nicely with kind of the work you and I have been doing, you know, piecemeal for the past several years. You know, I've been with Hodinkee for quite a while, and you joined last year. And I think we, you know, so much of what we do and write about ends up on Hodinkee, and we end up talking about it. And I think that said, what I'm happy about is that they gave us full independence to, despite the fact that we're part of the network, just business as usual. We'll just keep talking about, you know, adventure, travel, diving, and gear and watches. And I think that's it's kind of a really nice relationship going forward. I think listeners will be thrilled, and we will have more listeners, hopefully, which I'm really excited about.
Yeah, same here. And I hope this means that we can maybe actualize on some plans to do, you know, more events, maybe show up to some stuff.
Yeah, and we can both apologize to our existing listeners for our sort of extended hiatus for the past, I don't know, 6 weeks or so. You know, it's funny, I was getting sort of some feedback from people occasionally, you know, in places like comments on Hodinkee articles and on Instagram comments, where people would say, "Hey guys, you know, summer's over, time to start recording again." And I know we delayed our restart a little bit, but hopefully we'll be back and hit the ground running here. And I just want to add too that, you know, going forward, we would love to get feedback from listeners as to what we can do to improve the show, what you like, what you don't like, what you'd like us to do more of. You know, we're open, and I think this is kind of a logical time to not do a reboot. I think we're just going to keep on keeping on, but it's kind of a logical place to ask for feedback as we kind of kick off a new chapter here. So please, by all means, write to thegraynado@gmail.com, or you can certainly comment on Instagram or wherever you like. And I guess now you can even comment in the show notes on Hodinkee. Yeah.
To all of you who responded to the last call for feedback when we took the summer break, I really appreciate all the emails, both of support and of constructive criticism and all that. All fantastic. If you ever want to get in touch with either of us, both of us, whatever, like Jason said, thegraynado@gmail.com. We reply to every single email that we get, and we will continue to do so. So Jason, let's see if I can do this right off the dome. Hello and welcome to another episode of The Grey NATO, brought to you by Hodinkee. It's a loose discussion of travel, adventure, diving, gear, and most certainly watches. This is episode 66, and we thank you for listening.
That's official.
Hey, not bad.
Yeah, that's great.
All right, so while I think we're going to, in the future, you know, stick to kind of broader, like, actual topics for shows, that was part of the feedback that we got over the break, was that people really enjoyed kind of locked in topics that we would chat about.
Yeah.
This is not going to be that. We've been, you know, essentially not doing the show and really so busy. We've only been half kind of communicating on Slack for the last 6 weeks. So this is just going to be like a simple catch up. And so people can kind of understand where we were and what was still going on and the fact that we didn't just abandon the show and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So what have you been up to? I mean, it's funny, you said we really haven't been communicating much on Slack, and I feel like I sort of have been observing what you've been up to just through, you know, through Instagram and through the occasional Nuvo or Hodinkee article that you've done. But it looks like more cars, more cameras.
It's a lot of cars.
A lot of travel.
I had a really good run. If I remember, it was a lot of travel. It was a really busy time for travel. I adored it. It was great. And if I remember correctly, the last kind of car thing I talked about would have been the Bentley Bentayga in Portland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So since then, pretty impressive run. I'll do just a few minutes on each because there's quite a few. But I had I went to the global launch for the Aston Martin DBS, which is a 715 horsepower V12, kind of more wild version of a DB11.
Yeah.
And that car was... that car is just like absolutely incredible. And we were in southern Germany, right on the edge of Austria, right near the Eagle's Nest.
Oh, yeah.
And so the roads were incredible and the driving was wild. The car is very wild. I mean, it's a lot of power for the rear wheels. It makes a great noise. Like, it communicates really well in Germany. So you'd be driving like something of a low level maniac. Between, say, two small German towns, you'd get to the town, slow way down, you know, back down to the speed limit, get to like a crosswalk, and it's like a fire spitting V12. So of course, like, you see some kids, you put it in neutral and you rev it.
Yeah.
And like, or like in Vancouver, that's not going to make you any friends.
Yeah.
In Germany, people are clapping, you're getting thumbs up. Like, I mean, like, it's a bright red, like a glowing red.
Yeah.
DBS. So that was a really fantastic trip and an amazing car. And then I had a handful of cars on loan here in Vancouver. It was really, really nice way to fill, you know, some of the time at home with a little bit of added excitement. So I had the Ferrari GTC4 Lusso, which is the V12 four-seater.
Yeah.
Kind of a hatchback, mini wagon, shooting brake sort of idea.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not much, like, I mean, you look at it, it's incredible, like, just an amazing car, super comfortable, really fast. V12s that rev to 8,500 are always good. And, you know, you go through a tunnel, it sounds kind of like an old F1 car.
Wow.
Really fun. And I put four adults, like I put three adults in it plus me. Had a glass roof, which people really loved. And that car was an absolute treat. It actually, like, fit into my garage, so I could actually get it down the ramp.
Oh.
and into my underground parking, so that's great. I had the new M5, the 2018 M5. I bet you of, like, for cars and TGN listeners, like, a lot of them know the M5. I think that kind of fits better than a Ferrari or even an Aston into the kind of general milieu. But I think this is very much a return to, like, the E39 generation.
Huh.
So it's a very stoic looking car. It's very it was in this kind of brightish blue.
Yeah.
And on kind of blacked out wheels. And even then, I mean, if you didn't know M5s, if you didn't know the current generation M5 or the last gen, I feel like you wouldn't necessarily know it wasn't just a 5 series,
huh.
Like a 545 or a 540 that has, like, nice wheels.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you start it up and it's a 4.4 liter twin turbo V8. It rumbles like a muscle car. And actually driving it, that car is, the way it drives is the exact opposite of looking like a casual sedan.
Yeah.
It's just insane. It's 600 horsepower. It's insanely fast. I put both of my kids. I have two little girls. I put both of them in the back seat, in their car seats and everything, because it's a big car, has plenty of room. And then I put a GoPro in the back as well and just kind of launched it around.
Yeah.
And it was great. We had a blast with that car. Super fun. And my parents were in town when I had that car, and kind of neither of my parents had ever been in it, like a fairly quick car. So I got to give them a ride as well. And we put a fair amount of kilometers on it. That's a really, really good car.
That's a good car to have with family visiting. I mean, you know.
Yeah, that was perfect.
Four-door sedan. I mean, it's better than having a McLaren or something when you've got, you know, family in town.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the next car that I had, moving as quickly as I can through these, the next car that I had would definitely have not have been great for my parents or my kids, because not only did I sign an agreement that nobody under 18 would get in the car.
Oh, wow.
There's no way you could have fit a child seat in the race buckets. I had a Huracan, the Lamborghini Huracan Performante Spider.
Huh. Jeez.
And I don't really, like, I've written my piece for it. It's on Nuvo, and I can link to all these. It's fine. But I don't really have words for the way that car drove.
Huh.
Because, like, I think people have expectations for Lamborghini that, like, they look good and they make a great noise and they're fast, but otherwise they're not that dynamic.
Hmm.
And this car drove like an absolute razor blade.
Huh.
It has this incredibly trick aero setup called Ala, which I'll see if I can find a video explaining it, because I don't think people actually want me to explain the fact that, like, it uses a special type. I guess I am explaining it. It uses a special type of carbon fiber that allows them essentially make tunnels. And then they will actually draw air in from various parts of the vehicle and send it through the wing. The wing is fixed, but there's little flaps that open or close to shape how the air moves through the wing.
Oh, wow.
So if you're braking or turning, it funnels a ton of air over the wing to increase downforce.
Huh.
And if you're turning hard enough, it will actually stall the outside wheels.
Oh, wow.
So you get additional grip from that. It's also doing the exact same thing at the front with the front splitter. And then if you're just going for straight line speed, you're going down the back straight of some racetrack, it actually fully stalls the wing and removes it from the downforce equation of the car.
Huh.
It's super trick. The car is super loud and really exciting and really easy to drive, like, much too fast for the road.
Yeah.
I don't fit in it. Like, my hip to heel length was probably 3 inches too long for the car.
Oh.
And that's with the seat all the way back and all the way down. And then, you know, to make a car to look like the car looks amazing and it photographs beautifully, but to make the car look like that, it has to have a very steeply raked windshield.
Yeah.
So with the top up, there's enough headroom. I couldn't wear a helmet, but there is enough headroom.
Yeah.
But I can't see stoplights.
Oh, yeah.
I have to, like, duck forward. So I just drove it mostly with the top down. I could just see stoplights, like, through where the roof would have been.
Yeah.
You know, the combination of the drop top and a naturally aspirated V10 that revs to 8250 or something, 8500, something like that, and a really good DCT transmission and, you know, really fantastic tires and great steering. That car is full on bonkers, just really good. I liked that car a lot. I only had that car for like a day because I took it home to park it and it could not go into my garage, even with the nose lift system.
Oh, yeah.
So it had a nose lift that added, I don't know, 20 millimeters, maybe 2 centimeters or something to the front, maybe a bit more than that. And it still, I had a spotter and I still couldn't get it into the, over the, you know, where the ramp becomes the floor, basically. It's too low.
Jeez. So what did you do? You had to park it on the street?
No, I just took it back.
Oh, yeah.
I had been out all day shooting it. I had the photos I needed. I mean, I don't need more time. I had done several hundred kilometers in the car.
Oh,
so.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'll get into this other side of it, but, you know, I went down to LA for this event that Hodinkee did at the United Talent Agency's pop-up space.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was there for the week, and whenever I go to LA, I always send a few emails and try and get press loaners, and I got pretty lucky this time. So for the first half of that week or so, I had a McLaren 720S, which has to be the fastest car in the world right now over a twisty bit of road, or very close to. And then in the last half of the week, I had the new Ferrari Portofino. So I had I had two amazing cars, and I had good access to Angeles Crest. Had a really amazing morning in the 720, and then on the weekend went back with the Ferrari and took it up Angeles Crest as well. Grabbed some coffee at Newcomb's. It was pretty much like it's a perfect way to experience a car. Angeles Forest and Angeles Crest, which is just north of LA. When I had the McLaren out the one morning, I convinced Ben Clymer of Hodinkee and Anuri Acosta, also Hodinkee, and then also Brett Curry, a friend of the show and just all around great guy. If you're not following Brett, you should be following Brett, to kind of meet up in Flint Ridge, La Canada. There's like a Shell station at the bottom of Angeles Forest, and that's kind of the starting point. And so I had the McLaren, Ben had a Singer 911. Enery had a classic 911, and Brett rocked up in his new GTI, which was also a really lovely color and a great car. And so we went up into the hills that way. And yeah, you want to kind of, especially for photos, and when the 720 piece eventually goes live, I'm behind because I've had so many great cars. It's a great problem to have. But when the McLaren piece finally goes live, the photos turned out really well. So you kind of want to be there within 20 minutes of sunrise.
Yeah.
So that you can get up to one of the big parking lots where people go and do burnouts and sit with their cars. But this is like a Wednesday morning. We didn't see another car.
Oh, wow. Nice.
So went up, got the photos we needed, drove around a little bit, and then came back. You know, we were working that day, so it couldn't be super late. And the trip there is minutes, and the trip back is an hour or more.
Oh,
because you hit traffic.
Yeah.
On the back route. So that was good. And then when I had the Ferrari, I did basically the same thing. I started early and took my time, you know, drove out, and you can take kind of the full run from, or not the full run of the road, but kind of the run, the casual or the normal run is, you know, from that gas station up to Newcomb's, turn around and come back down the hill. I went a little bit further than that and got lots of great photos of the Ferrari, but yeah, you definitely want to, if I'm making a recommendation, you know, you go to LA, maybe you get a car or something on Turo, like a fun car. You want to gas up at the bottom of the highway and then head up while the sun is still coming up, and then drive until you're bored of driving and turn around and come back. I mean, technically you can take the route all the way to its other side. I've never driven it that far. I've gone, you know, several miles past Newcomb's and then turned around.
Huh.
And yeah, so an amazing time in LA, and I can go more into the Hodinkee UTA thing in a bit. But to wrap this up, I saved kind of the craziest for last. I got to drive. I had about an hour in a Bugatti Chiron.
Wow. Same trip? All three cars in the same trip? Oh, wow.
No, this is 2 days after I got back. It was a press and like buyer preview for Vancouver.
Jeez.
Wow. So they had the car, they had a Chiron in town for the luxury supercar weekend, and then it stayed in town to do these kind of 2 or 3 days of demos with a Bugatti test driver out of North Van. And so that's, for anyone who doesn't know, that's, I'm going to talk in Canadian dollars, but it's $3.1 million is where you start. The one I drove was around 3.4. So you're looking at, you know, somewhere in the high twos for USD. I think it's 2.5 euro is the starting point for Europe. Wow. And 1,479 horsepower. I don't remember the torque figure at the moment. I believe it's around about 1,200.
Wow.
I mean, like I drove a Veyron. I had kind of the same rough experience in a Veyron where I went out with, I went out with the factory driver, Andy Wallace, who, if you follow that kind of stuff, is amazing. In the Veyron, and the Veyron was great, was really cool, but the Chiron's next level. I mean, it's 30% more horsepower. It's way more tied down as far as the front end feel and the steering. It's still just beautiful. That's one just to kind of watch for my piece. I put a lot of work into the piece for Nuvo, so that'll be out probably before this episode comes out. So I'll link it if I can. But really, just an absolutely crazy, crazy car that it even exists. And the way that it can put on speed without adding any drama, like it's not only vastly faster than something like the Huracan Performante, but the Performante was kind of scary.
Yeah.
This, it just kind of feels like something's pushing against your chest and you look down and you're at like 4x the speed limit.
Wow.
It makes some noise, but not a crazy amount of noise. It's very comfortable. And then full throttle is just, it's something else. Like, it makes your hand shake. It's great.
Yeah.
It's really great. So I've rambled for a while about cars. You did a bunch of diving. That's what I know from your Instagram. Tell me about some of the diving.
Yeah. I mean, after we kind of took our hiatus, late summer here for me tends to be, sort of the start of what I consider Great Lakes diving season, simply because the water warms up to the point where it's a little more tolerable than it is in the early summer. And so I did a couple of Great Lakes trips. I did one, I think last time we spoke, or one of the last episodes we did, I had talked about the trip over to Lake Huron to dive the Daniel Morrell wreck with Becky Kagan Schott and my buddy Chris. And since then, I did two other trips. I did a trip down to Milwaukee during a week when it was pretty miserable, strange weather conditions. We had a whole week, almost a whole week of high winds and high seas that kind of kept us off the boat, which was a little frustrating. We had some photography that we had to do underwater, and we were sort of sitting on our hands for a week, but finally got out for a day and did a little bit of diving. And I finally got to try out my new dry suit, which I think I had talked about in a past episode, from Aquala, which is a brand out of Louisiana that was started by a friend, Ty Alley, who's a longtime friend of Doxa. And I had met him on the Mission 31 trip that I did with Fabien Cousteau and Doxa back in, I don't remember what year it was, but 5 years ago or so. And Ty bought the name of Aquila, the company, which is a very old dry suit maker from 1950. And he's got kind of three levels of dry suit. One is a very retro one that kind of twist ties shut like a plastic bag, which would be for really hardcore retro divers. And then he has sort of a middle, sort of splits the difference model that's kind of retro but has some modern conveniences. And then he custom made the Cordell, which is his kind of top of the line dry suit for me, and I got to try it out. It uses their multi-ply rubber material, so it looks very much like an old rubber dry suit, but it uses the modern zips and modern rear zipper, and then the SciTech valves on the for the venting and for the fill valve on the chest. And so it was really fun to try that out. It's a great suit. I've always bought my dry suits kind of secondhand, so they were always a bit of a compromise. And this one, you know, fit me really well. And the material, I'd never dived in a rubber suit. I've always had, you know, shell suits. And this one was, it was really, really nice because it's very flexible. It's easy to get on and off. And underwater, it's very mobile. It allows you to kind of twist and turn and reach things. And so I really, really liked it. Of course, it dries, you know, it just doesn't get wet like some shell suits that are made of Cordura and things like that. So that was fun. And then, so we dove two wrecks on that trip. One of them was one that I've done many times, which is the Prince Willem V, which is a Dutch freighter that sank in the 50s. But then before that, we went out to the, it's a sunken car ferry called the SS Milwaukee that sank in 1929. And it's a fascinating wreck. In fact, it was featured on, there used to be a show called Shipwreck Hunters, I think, or Shipwreck Detectives, I think, with Richie Kohler and John Chatterton.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And they actually went there because it's a really interesting wreck that has some mystery around it. And it had set off from north of Milwaukee and was headed across Lake Michigan to Michigan with a load of passengers and boxcars, railroad cars. And at some point, the seas were quite high. I think this was in autumn. And you get those late summer fall storms. And the Seagate gave in. The Seagate is on the back of a ferry, if you can picture it. It kind of hinges down and seals against the back of the boat. And that crushed in at some point during the storm, and the ferry flooded and sank. And it makes for a very interesting dive because you get boxcars. You get actual railroad boxcars that are sitting on the lake bed with the wreck on top of it. So you can dive under the wreck and you see the entire railroad boxcars underneath the ship, which landed on top of it. And it's just a huge wreck. I mean, it's, you know, I don't know, 300 or 400 feet long and about 130 feet deep. So it's a bit challenging, but it makes for a very interesting, very interesting dive. So
yeah, sounds it.
So we did that for we actually only got out for one day, and we kind of crammed in three dives on that day and did a bunch of photography and had a proper adventure. And then I think it was only about 2 weeks later, my wife and I did a really fun road trip over to the other side of Lake Huron, which was actually on your side of the border over in Ontario. There's a peninsula that sticks up into Lake Huron called the Bruce Peninsula, and there's a small town at the tip of it called Tobermory. And apparently it's a real vacation spot for people from Toronto and kind of that surrounding
Absolutely,
area.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I had no idea that, naively, that the same weekend that we went, which was the American Labor Day, is also Canadian Labor Day. So it was absolutely jammed with people. But we rented a little cottage right on the water, and we did, I think we did 3 days of diving.
Nice.
And it's, if you are into wreck diving and somewhat cold water, I really highly recommend making the journey there because there are, you know, probably, you know, half a dozen to, you know, 10 really high quality old wooden schooner and steamer wrecks that are in fairly shallow water there. So it makes for really not terribly difficult wreck diving, and the water was not that cold. It was, I would say, I don't know, maybe I think I saw 65 Fahrenheit, which is probably 17 centigrade or thereabouts. And I mean, some of the wrecks, there's a shore dive that you just, there's a staircase that goes right into the water, right off the, just right off the road.
Oh, I love that.
And it's just a rock bottom, just kind of big sort of polished boulders and pebbles. And there are no less than four tugboats that are sunk there, not intentionally, but they, over the history, they all sort of ended up there lying on the bottom, and they do classes there because you literally sink down 15 feet below the water, you know, 5 meters or thereabouts, and you're on the wreck, and it goes down to a maximum of maybe 30 feet or 10 meters. So it's really easy kind of cruising around. We went out on a boat a couple of days with a local dive shop there called Diver's Den, and they run a big operation there, several boats a day, and we went out with them 2 days and dove a couple of other shallow wrecks that are almost, you know, snorkelable. They're so shallow, but they're, you know, big, long wooden wrecks, very well preserved. So that was really fun. And then the last day we were there, we did another shore dive off of there's a lighthouse called the Big Tub Harbor. Is kind of a natural harbor, and at the point sits a 1800s lighthouse. And we parked our car at the little parking lot there and humped our gear to the end of the point. And there's a little bench there, and we suited up, and you're right at the lighthouse. We just walked in and stepped off the edge, and you go straight down, and it's just this sort of wall dive with these overhangs and big tumbling boulders and
very cool.
Decent fish life. So it was a great trip. It was a very long drive from Minneapolis, of course. It took a couple of days to get there, a couple of days back. We took the ferry across Lake Michigan to get there, but really was a worthwhile getaway kind of at the end of the summer. We've been talking about doing that trip for years, and it didn't disappoint. So, yeah, it was good. I had one bit of a snafu on that trip, an equipment issue. I had brought my Nikonos 5 underwater film camera to do some photography and loaded it up with some black and white film because I thought it would be really great to get a lot of great...
What emulsion?
Underwater shots. I used, I think on that one I had the... Yeah, I had Tri-X.
Oh, okay. You used 400 for underwater? Or?
Yeah, it was 400. And I brought another roll of 3200 Ilford, which I, because of this issue, I couldn't load up. So I only managed to get a roll of film shot. But I was climbing back on the boat after one of the dives, and I had set the camera on the transom of the boat, climbed the ladder, sat down, reached over to get my camera, and the lens was... these lenses are just a bayonet fit on the front mm-hmm. of the camera body, and it had come loose and was sitting on the transom next to the camera. So I did get moisture inside, and I'm still debating whether it's worthwhile to get the camera dried out and fixed. There's a guy in Texas who does the work, but it's almost more cost effective just to buy a new one. These cameras aren't very expensive anymore.
Okay.
And then I came home, and you know, the film was okay for the most part. And, I, you know, kind of tried my hand at processing at the kitchen sink, and, you know, I'm sure I didn't do as good a job as the labs would have done. The photos are a little sort of mysterious and dark, looking, but I think it kind of adds to the overall effect. So,
for sure.
Yeah, it was good. And then, you know, just more recently, in fact, today, as we're recording this, my story on Hodinkee about, free diving with the new Ulysse Nardin, diver chronometer went up on the website. Did a quick story about that. Got to dive with Fred Buell, who's a Belgian free diver, who, if you aren't following him on Instagram, he's well worth it. He's a really interesting sort of Zen master of free diving, who does a lot of work with sharks and underwater photography. He's very much a purist. He doesn't use artificial light. He just says he just goes down with his fins and his mask and his camera. And a lot of scientists and scientific organizations employ his skills to help with shark tagging because he's obviously very good at it. He's somewhat fearless, but free diving mm-hmm. is a very good way to tag sharks because you don't spook them with the bubbles. And I had a good chance to kind of get to know Fred a little bit, and we did a bit of free diving in the Mediterranean, which was a real trip. I'm not a very accomplished freediver, but I think it's always kind of fun to do it and good skill to have for kind of the odd time when you drop something off the dock and you have to go get it. So,
for sure.
So yeah,
that's an awesome. It looked like a great trip.
Yeah. So you know,
what'd you think of Monaco?
You know, the city, I was expecting something a little more visually beautiful.
Yeah.
It's just packed apartment buildings because there's so little space that everything kind of has to go up. But it was neat to be there. I've heard so much about it. And, we were there for the timing was such that the yacht show was going on and it was just, it was huge. I mean, it was just absolutely huge. It was in the marina and, you know, lots of big, you know, kind of the watercraft version of the cars you've been driving, you know, just, you know, $120 million super yachts with two helicopter pads and, you know, just every possible amenity and luxury that you could imagine. And we got to tour one and, I just walked the show.
Like one of the really big boats?
Yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. We got to, so we got to tour, one of the big yachts. It was called the Dar, and it was actually the yacht that won the award for the best kind of best in show for this year. And it had just been purchased and the woman that, from Venice who had done all of the interior design work gave us the tour of the inside. And I mean,
was it incredible?
It was beyond words. You know, every level, every turn, every cabin, every room you go in. I mean, there was a wellness center with a massage room and then its own sauna. And a weight room with, you know, all modern equipment. It blew my mind, you know, and to the level of detail, you know, to a certain degree, it's akin to what people appreciate about, you know, haute horlogerie watches, the hand finishing and things. All of the materials, the embroidery and the cut leather that's used for wallpaper and the custom furniture that's made so it can rotate so you can have conversations in two different directions and, you know, all of this kind of stuff was, it just blew my mind. But the rest of the yacht show is, it's a trade show. I mean, it was tent after tent of companies selling everything from cigar humidors to sun awnings to ROVs and mini submarines and, you know, just, it was a really eye-opening, really an interesting experience.
That's wild. I know I watched a video the other day that was from the Monaco Yacht Show. It was a tour of a $145 million yacht.
Yeah.
And like one, I can't, like, you can't, like, when you actually consider that number,
yeah,
it's meaningless. Like, I don't, like, I can't, I have no contextualization for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm watching this video of these guys walking around this yacht, and, like, if they told me, like, oh, we're in a hotel.
Yeah.
Like, it had, the boat had, like, a lobby
that
had multiple, that had, like, access to multiple floors.
Yeah. Oh, it's an elevator, spiral staircase, everything's carpeted, leather.
I mean, you know where I mean? Like, like, there'd be, like, a walkway, and if you, like, leaned over the edge of the walkway, you could look down into a lower floor. This is, and, like, the other thing that I find, and this is going to be, like, this must be how I'm wired, maybe. It must be, but... I'm watching that video or I'm listening to you talk about this and all my brain is telling me is this could sink so easily.
Yeah, yeah.
The smallest mistake and it's all underwater.
Yeah, right. Yeah, just run it aground somewhere. Yeah.
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 Yeah. I mean, like, it could all, like, $145 million could just sink.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was fun. And then I had posted some photos on Instagram while I was walking around because there were there was a whole section of really high luxury cars. What's the Mercedes tuner, Brabus or Brabus?
Oh yeah, Brabus.
Brabus, and there was a Shelby Cobra. Dealer, I guess.
Mighty. Okay. Must have been like a resto or a,
yeah,
a
restoration
replica dealer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So that was neat. And then I snuck away in the afternoon after kind of wandering the show. I managed to get up to the Museum of Oceanography, which is a place I've wanted to go to for years. It's quite famous. Cousteau himself, Jacques Cousteau, was the director of the museum from 1957 until 88, I think. So he was there a long time. And
so cool.
It was founded by Prince Albert I, who was, you know, the ruler of Monaco back in the early 1900s and kind of a pioneering sort of amateur scientist when it comes to oceanography. Mm-hmm. And he had a mega yacht of his era, I guess, and sailed around the world and collected specimens and did all sorts of experiments, and they had a lot of his fish that he had caught, sort of preserved in formaldehyde, still kind of in cases, and big whale skeletons and some old dive gear. And so the building itself
looked awesome.
The building itself was the highlight for me. It's built kind of into the cliffside right above the sea, and it just looks like this big fortress. And inside was similarly impressive. So it was good. It was a good trip. It was a very short trip, and my flight got canceled, so I had to stay an extra day in a Paris airport hotel. But overall, you know, for 4 days, you know, free diving with Fred Buell and doing the Oceanography Museum and touring a mega yacht were made it all worth it. So it was great.
And you stayed like right next to Charles de Gaulle? Did you get a chance to kick down to Paris for a bit?
No, the flight, you know, by the time we got off the plane and whatnot, it was late afternoon, and we were a good hour from downtown. We were right near the airport, so I was pretty beat, yeah. And it was just, I had to get up in the morning and go back to the airport. So, but south of France, you know, south of France was pretty great. You know, we flew into Nice and then stayed at the Cap d'Antibes Eden Rock Hotel, which is a very famous, you know, from the sort of movie star set in the 50s and royalty
sure.
and whatever. So it was. It was great. Ulysse Nardin treated us really well, and I met some fun people, so it was really good.
Very cool, man.
Yeah. What about you? You've also been dabbling in a little film shooting too.
Yeah, no, I've been putting roles out. It's been good. First up, I want to make like a very. I should have asked if he wanted his full name said on the show. I'm just going to assume some anonymity's fine. Adam, if you're listening, I sent you an email. Adam, a listener. Was very kind, DM'd me to offer to send kind of a box of Canon photo equipment that was his grandfather's that he just had in storage.
Wow.
And what arrived is like several lenses and essentially a factory fresh AE-1 program.
Wow.
Adam, I cannot thank you enough. I put two rolls through the AE-1 program already. It literally feels brand new. It runs like new. It's incredible. The lenses you sent have been super fun, and I've been shooting a bunch with them. I even now have enough lenses to necessitate an adapter for the E-mount to go to my Sony. So I've been one of the lenses Adam sent along is literally a factory fresh 35 to 70 millimeter f/2.8, which is this, wow, like it's all metal and super heavy and really gorgeous and has like really lovely colored paint in the scales and the listings. And Adam, I'm just having a blast with this stuff. Thank you so much for sending it. It was very sweet of you, and it will all get to use either from me or you know, passed along to other photo enthusiasts. It's fantastic. It was super, super fun. But so I've got a handful of new lenses, been shooting a ton, and then just a couple days ago there was like a photography swap meet in Vancouver.
Oh, nice.
And so I packed up my daughter and we went down there, and she got like a Canon point and shoot from probably 6 or 7 years ago.
Oh, wow.
For $5.
Wow. That's awesome.
So it's like, you know, like one of those tiny things that you would put around your wrist.
Huh.
You know, like before phones had good cameras, the kind of thing that everybody had.
Yeah.
Somewhere in their home to take pictures of family and stuff. But it's like a 12 megapixel, it's a power shot or something. With a battery, yeah, and a charger, and like, jeez, you go to one of these shows, and it's rammed. There's,
yeah,
so many people there.
Yeah,
she's the only kid,
yeah,
in the place.
Yeah,
and like everybody's talking to her, like, "Hey, it's so nice to see a kid into photography." She's almost in tears because all these strangers are talking to her.
Yeah,
and then this guy sees her. He's like chill. He doesn't say anything to her directly. He looks at me. He's like, "She have a camera?" I'm like, "Nah." And he's like, "How about this?" And he like digs around on his table and pulls out this thing. He's like, $5. I was like, yeah, $5.
Wow.
So we're doing that. And then I got lucky. You really had to look around, especially like, you know, if you're hunting for something like, I'm sure, Jason, you know this, like a lot of Nikkor glass looks the same on a table. You,
yeah,
really have to like read the front lens element of all of them to know really what you're looking at, unless it's kind of a very strange lens.
Yeah.
But I did, I don't know, 7-8 laps of this show, and finally came across a 50 f1.4,
Wow.
Which nice. Was a one, you know, obviously if you can find it slash afford it, the 50 F12L, the later generation of that lens, you're going to look at closer to $800 US for that.
Huh.
I was able to get this one, which is not as good, but it's going to be a very good for my uses for like 80 Canadian.
Wow, jeez.
And it looks essentially brand new, and I've yet to use it on the AE1, but I have adapted it to the Sony, and it's fantastic. I put up a ton of photos yesterday night of just some flowers around Vancouver that I shot with it. Really fun, super super. Obviously, being a 1.4, like super super bokeh, and yeah, all in all, I'm absolutely loving the whole film thing. And it's been nothing short of a blast. I'm now, you know, often carrying now a second camera because if I see something, I'm like, ooh, I think that's more filmy.
Oh, yeah, right.
I'll try and get a film shot of it. So,
yeah, the swap meets are always a kick. There's an annual tent sale that one of the big camera stores here does. And it's just people line up for an hour before it opens. And then, you know, the table where all the old lenses are is just everyone like runs to it, and you're lucky if you can find like the good stuff. You have to get there right away. All the, you know, the really fast lenses and the really kind of coveted sort of focal lengths are always, you know, gone in the first hour of the show. So it's
absolutely,
it's a blast.
This is great. Basically, like I know that we've talked both, like we've both said people should get into film if they have the time and the money to do so.
Yeah.
The equipment is cheap. The actual film part of it kind of isn't.
Yeah.
You know, for your 30 shots, I think I'm probably paying a little bit more than $1 a photo.
Yeah.
All said and done.
Yeah.
Which is fine for the fun. It's fine.
Yeah.
But it this can't be the way that I operate all of my photos.
Right.
Obviously.
Right.
But then I still think what I'm learning again and again is like if you have a camera that has focus peaking.
Yeah.
Just buy really good old glass. It costs nothing.
Yeah.
Like this, the 50 F1.8 or, I mean, like a 50 F1.8 is like, they're like, I saw them for $5.
Yeah, right.
And if you want the 1.4, you're closer to $100. This is, again, like Canadian and swap meet prices. And then you go on to something like eBay, you can find the 50 F1.2L, you know, an amazing, legitimately crazy good lens. And, you know, they're less than $1,000, whereas if you wanted to get a legitimately crazy good modern Canon lens,
yeah,
it could be $3,500.
Right. Yeah.
I just think, like, $50 goes a real long way these days in vintage lenses, whether you want to go M42 in, like, an Asahi Pentax 50mm or something like Adapt to FD or Nikkor, and you just don't have autofocus, but really, like, with a bit of practice... The only time that I find it really annoying is when you're trying to get that one picture of like one of my kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're little kids. They're never not moving. They're practically vibrating all the time.
Right. Yeah.
And so that can be kind of tough. But outside of that, I think like for a lot of the type of photography where like you see something that's not moving and you want to take a picture of it, a car, a watch, or whatever, I think that's something that everybody should be considering. My brother just bought an A6000.
Oh, yeah.
And wrote me. And as soon as he wrote me, I was like, don't buy any lenses. I got stuff here for you.
Yeah. Because
he's coming to visit me in a couple weeks
on
his way to Japan. And I was like, don't buy any lenses. I got you. So I picked him up a couple like adapters.
Yeah.
And so I'll set him up with like a Helios and probably a Canon 50 1.8.
Boy, Japan is a dangerous place if you're into cameras. And if he just got a camera and he's starting to get into that sort of thing, it's there's a spectacular kind of set of used camera stores in kind of the same area of Tokyo. And it's like, if he wanders in there, you almost can't leave without, you know, buying something spectacular.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I think that would be super tempting. It's not unlike watches. You see these stores where they have the, you know, the little glass front areas, and it's just like there's no more square inch for watch or lens. The camera thing has been really great. It brings me so much happiness. I mean, like I like it at a gear level.
Yeah,
I like that it's not hugely expensive. What I actually kind of like about it too is, like I was saying, is a lot of these things, like if you spend $50 on something and then like you don't use it for a couple months,
yeah,
you're just gonna give it to someone.
Right
So these things live, like they live on. They have like, because they have no autofocus, they're not tied to cameras that really aged out.
Right.
Like a film camera, like an AE-1P is the same now as it was a while ago, but you look at something like that Canon mm-hmm. that I bought for $5.
Yeah.
It's worth about $5.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so it's really strange where these generations of technology start to reflect back mm-hmm. on like what's useful and what isn't. And now digital became so ubiquitous so quickly.
Yeah.
And then the quality is still increasing. I mean, now we have, like, since you and I last did an episode, we have full frame mirrorless from Nikon and Canon.
Yeah.
And a new cooperation between Panasonic and Leica. Like, we could go deep into that stuff.
Yeah.
I would love a chance to shoot any of it.
Yeah.
But there's like full frame mirrorless is definitely the next big wing.
Yep.
And what I like about that is it's all still fully adaptable to old lenses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I like that, the other thing to consider is a lot of these lenses that do have autofocus, you can adapt them using a more expensive adapter and maintain the AF.
Yeah.
It's usually not as fast as the native focusing system.
Mm-hmm.
But man, it really is like a world where like now you can really kind of be agnostic to a lens system, especially if you don't need AF.
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and super people, fun people certainly way. Got along for decades without autofocus. So, you know, it's definitely doable. We should probably talk about watches a little bit, right? I mean, I think we both picked up something since we last spoke, kind of on the inexpensive side, but I think yours takes the cake for super inexpensive.
I've got a couple cheap gold Casios, which are maybe the most money I've ever spent on a watch.
A couple? Oh, I didn't know about.
Yeah, wow. So I have one that the piece is already on Hodinkee. I can link to it. It's kind of a world timer with a gold bracelet. It's plastic. The case is plastic. The bracelet's metal. I'm still wearing it almost all the time. Like, I just really like it.
Wow.
And I've started sleeping with a watch on because these digital watches, they weigh nothing and they have a backlight.
Huh.
So I don't sleep that well. I'm not that great of a sleeper these days. So I'm up kind of at various times during the night, and I find that these I find that these ones with the backlight are actually pretty handy. They're not as bulky as like a dive watch that has a bunch of lume. I can't really sleep with a big Seiko on.
Yeah.
So I have this one, which is the A500 WGA-9DF World Timer, which I really love, and it was $45. And I also have an F-91W. So the F91 is very famous. It's like the entry level Casio digital.
Yeah.
Super, super basic. But I bought this one because it's a gold tone case that kind of has like a fully matte finish on a black rubber strap. If this thing weighs like 20 grams, I'd be surprised. And the other thing I like about it is it has like the even previous generation backlight. So like the World Timer one doesn't have like Indiglo. It has like an LED on the edge of the display that shines across it.
Oh yeah.
Which I like, but it's fairly bright.
Yeah.
But this F91 is even cheaper.
Oh yeah.
So it has a little LED on the edge of the display. It's just not that bright. So it's really, this is a really nice watch, like to check what time it is at 2:30 in the morning when you're,
yeah,
you know, kind of rolling around in bed and not like, I get tired of like, you want to check the time on your phone.
Yeah.
And it's so bright.
Yeah.
It's bright enough to wake up the person next to you in bed easily. And so, yeah, I like these F91s. I just kind of enjoying cheap Casios right now. And the piece for the World Timer went up. And if you dig the style, they make a steel one as well. I think it's a super handy watch, especially if you travel a lot and you don't want to carry something, a watch that you're concerned about or don't want to bang up around, depending on, you know, how you feel about wearing the watch. And I think these are fun, super fun, really.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned middle of the night time checks because I'm kind of in the throes of jet lag from my recent trip, and I find that that's when having some lume or some sort of a time display in the middle of the night, you know, you wake up and it's so disorienting. You don't know if, especially this time of year here in Minnesota, it's dark till almost 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, mm-hmm. Is it 3 a.m. or is it 5:30? Because there's a big difference when you're jet lagged. Like, it feels better if it's 5:30, and mm-hmm. Yeah, so a little trickling sort of backlight would be handy.
Yeah, I like them. I mean, like, I don't know, like, if you can have more fun for $50 when it comes to watches, especially as a palate cleanser, where I'm normally wearing a Rolex or I'm addicted to wearing the Doxa. It's on.
Yeah.
I pretty much wear it every day, all day.
Yeah.
And especially if I'm home and I don't need a second time zone. But these are really fun to switch up, and I've been wearing the F91 while running because you don't even feel it on your wrist.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And it has a chronograph, so I know when to turn around.
Yeah.
But you picked up a vintage piece, right?
I did, yeah. It was a bit of an impulse buy. In fact, I think it was either while I was on my trip last week or just before I left. Our good buddy over there, Retro Watch Guy, based in Colorado.
Jordan.
Jordan, yeah. He had put up something on Instagram about this little Aquadive dive watch model. I think it's reference 566. And kind of a quirky, kind of squarish case. Really beautiful dial with a big lollipop sweep hand. And it was in like perfect condition. And he even had the box, the papers, the receipt from the store where it was bought. You know, and that kind of stuff usually doesn't matter to me, but it was just kind of the right price at the right time. And I had been kind of chasing something else that was exponentially more expensive than that, and sort of was a little disheartened when I came to the conclusion that I probably wasn't going to get that one. And then this came along and I was like, okay, this will kind of, you know, soften the blow a little bit. And it came the day after I got home, and it's just a fun little watch. I haven't measured it, but it's quite small, and it's not kind of a hardcore tool dive watch, but it's just the right sort of lightweight, fun little sports watch that looks good on a bunch of straps. And funny, I was looking at the kind of faded out little flimsy paper receipt, and it was originally bought in 1975 for $59 with tax from a place just a few miles from where I grew up. So I thought it was really, really kind of a neat little score. So
that's great, man. It's a really sweet little watch too. And Jordan's got lots of great stuff. That's retrowatchguy.com or retrowatchguy on
Boy, he sure does.
Instagram.
Yeah.
He's got lots of fantastic stuff. I showed you that chronograph that I missed.
Yeah. Yeah.
The gold one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I shouldn't have slept on that. It was just crazy, like Walkman with bright colors and like a gold toned case. I would be wearing that constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hopefully, you know, one of those pops up sometime in the future. But speaking of vintage watches, I got to see a handful of great stuff. Went down for a week for that UTA pop-up with Hodinkee.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, that was all over the site. It was all over my Instagram. So I don't know necessarily how much explanation is needed. But I did just want to say thank you to everyone who came out and, you know, chatted me up about TGN and came to say hi and stopped by just to see the watches and be friendly. You know, we had essentially office hours for a week at this space.
Huh.
And it was this gorgeous space. We did a couple of meetups. We did a couple of podcasts. And it came together really, really well. And, you know, I got a chance to essentially wear a gold AP all week.
Wow.
A vintage gold Royal Oak, which is super fun. Like, way too much fun. And it didn't, though, because, you know, you can't lie a Royal Oak flat.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
It couldn't fit in the display cases. So I came across it in the stock for the shop that they were running along with the pop-up. And I was like, hey, what's up with this? And they're like, you can't fit it in the display case. And I was like, I'll wear it around. do you guys a favor. And so, yeah, it was a really great time. The meetups were super fun. A lot of great people showed up. And we had more than a handful of listeners that came, you know, just to say hi and offer some support and, you know, wish that the show was coming back soon. So
nice.
Anytime we get a chance to meet up with anyone who's a listener is super fun. And I had a blast in LA. I hope Hodinkee elects to do something like that again soon.
Nice. Very cool. Yeah, it is fun to meet people in person, and hope we get to do more of that.
For sure. Well, I think we're mostly caught up, wouldn't you say?
I think so. Yeah. We could jump into final notes.
Yeah, let's do it.
Go ahead. Yeah. What's your first one?
My first one is a movie called Mountains of Storms, which if you're an adventure movie aficionado, you will have heard of and possibly seen. But it was basically a movie made about Doug Tompkins and Yvonne Chouinard, along with a couple other guys, you know, traveled down to Patagonia to climb Mount Fitzroy.
Oh, yeah.
And they made this movie about it. It's been considered kind of an underground cult classic, a little bit hard to find. And they're re-releasing the film. And according to adventure-journal.com, which is a great site, you should definitely be following. But according to them, after kind of a week of doing like live screenings at various Patagonia stores around North America, which, you know, they did in Vancouver last night, and I just wasn't able to make it, they will be releasing the film online on the 9th. I believe this episode of TGN comes out on the 11th. So if you're listening to this, you should be able to, I don't know if it's going to be like a buy the film or donate to a cause and get the film or just stream it online. I have no idea.
Yeah.
But once I know, I will put it in the show notes, as I'm very excited to see this movie. I think it's going to be really cool. They put out a really simple, straightforward trailer.
Yeah.
We've talked a lot about Chouinard and Tompkins in the past, you know, heroes, legends, all of that. And I think it'll be really fun to be able to see that movie.
Yeah, and I think we've talked about it before, but I think if as kind of a nice little precursor to that, or even a follow-up to that, the film and book, 180 Degrees South, was inspired by this Mountain of Storms. The creator of that, Jeff Johnson, who's a longtime Patagonia guy and photographer, he had seen this film somewhere, I guess because he works with Patagonia. And so if you watch 180 Degrees South, it intersperses some footage from Mountain of Storms, and even the little bit of footage looks really cool. And those guys, when they set out on that trip back in the 60s, it was they called themselves Conquerors of the Useless. And I think, you know, it was kind of that philosophy, I think, that Chouinard still has. It's just that sort of, you know, devil may care, I'm doing what I want kind of mentality that, I don't know, I think even nowadays it still rings so true with so many of kind of the heroes that you and I talk about a lot.
Absolutely. And I mean, the Adventure Journal in their write-up, you know, this was all done in 1968.
Yeah.
So this is for the 50th anniversary of the film. But for the write-up, they said, you know, it's kind of one part Jacques Cousteau project, one part Endless Summer, and one part Wes Anderson, which is kind of like,
yeah,
okay, you're coming right at us,
yeah,
with that.
Yeah.
That's right in the lane. So I'm excited, and by the time you're listening to this, I believe you'll be able to find it online. And even if there's a small cost, I still think it's a great option for final notes.
Yeah. My first one today is a fairly short article. It was on Popular Mechanics, and it's called How the U.S. is Recovering Oil from a Nuked Warship. So not a very imaginative title, but very tells you exactly what it's about. Mm-hmm. People might be familiar with Bikini Atoll, which is a coral atoll in the Pacific where the U.S. did a lot of atomic bomb testing.
For sure.
And they would sort of anchor entire fleets of kind of retired warships in the waters around the atoll, and then they were dropping these atomic bombs and seeing kind of what the effects were. Well, you know, as luck would have it, some of these ships didn't entirely break apart, or and a lot of them were carrying hazardous material like, you know, oil and fuel and things like that. And one of them was a ship called the Prince Eugen, which was a German warship that was captured during World War II, and they used that as one of the target ships. And during the bombing, I think they bombed it twice, and it didn't sink, but it kind of turned turtle, capsized, and sank, and it's in very shallow water there. But now, of course, after 70-some years, the hull is starting to corrode to the point where I think it's 124,000 gallons or something of heavy fuel oil is inside, and it's starting to leak out. So the Navy has undertaken this effort to get that oil out before it leaks and just creates this environmental disaster. So this article kind of goes into, you know, what the Navy is doing with the ship, how they're planning to get the oil out using a hot tapping technique with divers and a support ship. And so it's kind of an interesting story, short read, but there's an embedded video and some really kind of cool photos. So check that out. That's my first offering today.
Very cool. My next pick is a website that sells kind of a range of products. It's the Observer Collection. And this is a website run by a gentleman that I believe we spoke about before, Robert Spangle, who's at 1000 Yard Style on Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
Robert and I were kind of DMing over the past little while, and then I met him while I was in LA for a piece for an upcoming project with Hodinkee. And the Observer Collection stuff is pretty interesting. It's all, like, Robert travels a ton. So it's all very finely tuned travel gear that has like a very specific aesthetic and very high quality. So the two things that I've experienced so far, the first one is called the Peacekeeper. That's P-I-E-C-E.
Oh, yeah.
And it's two pieces. So he makes these really beautiful bags.
Mm-hmm.
And with the offcuts of some of the suede used with the bags are called tangos. With the offcuts, he applies a sticker backing, and then it's essentially two pieces of suede, and you stick them on your laptop, kind of where your wrists touch the laptop,
yeah.
And it keeps your bracelet or the buckle on your NATO or whatever from kind of annoyingly rubbing against the metal plastic, depending on your laptop.
Yeah.
And I always, you know, depending on the strap I'm wearing, I think a lot of people, if I know I have a bunch of work to do at a laptop, I'll take the watch off. But if you're at an airport,
yeah,
or at some lounge, that's not a great idea, depending on where you are.
Yeah.
If you're at home, who cares? You take it off, you put it on your table, the watch is at no risk. But if you're at a coffee shop or, like I said, an airport lounge or something, like, anyways, I was kind of skeptical when, you know, we were DMing and he said, hey, I'll send you something. It looks like you do a fair amount of travel. Like, let me know what you think. And I didn't know what he'd send. And he sent these things and I absolutely love them. They've been on my laptop now for probably a couple months.
Huh.
And my feedback is that they are great. I have a mid-2014 MacBook Pro. He's tested it on several different types, but for mine, it does not impede the opening or closing of the lid. I would say you probably don't need both stickers, because obviously you probably only have a watch on one wrist, but you might have bracelets or something on the other wrist, depending on your decisions there. The reason I think that you stick both on is so that there's no asymmetry in pressure to the screen.
Oh, sure.
But I've really liked these. They're $21. They're made from offcuts, so it's kind of like a non-waste project, which I really like as well. And if you're the type that, you know, works on a laptop frequently and finds that the watch is kind of annoying, maybe this is an option. So I'll throw the link in the show notes, of course, but that's the Observer Collection Peacekeeper.
Yeah. Huh.
The other one is kind of a travel wallet, which I'm just starting to get into, but it's called the Papa Passport Wallet. And it has all these pockets that are specifically designed for, like, carrying different types of travel paperwork.
Yeah.
Whether it's like a Paris bus pass is a certain width, or the tube pass is a certain width, or, you know, there's some spot for cash or a notebook and a passport. There's a front pocket that allows you to carry a boarding pass, but not have to take it out of the wallet to have it scanned.
Oh, yeah.
It's, again, just kind of like he's taken something like feedback from doing so much travel and applied it to kind of a very niche project.
Sure.
But if you like the idea of having kind of a one space in your bag for a pen, all of your kind of travel cards, cash, and then things like could be a small phone or a boarding pass can slot in the front. Pretty cool, made out of really gorgeous leather. I have a black one here, and this one's a little bit more expensive, but I think if you see the handiwork, if you go to the website and kind of see the what goes into it, you'd get it. This is about $165, and really, really cool. Robert, thank you for setting me up with both of those. Both have been really handy as I've been traveling, so
very
really
cool.
Really neat stuff with the Observer Collection, and yeah, that's my other final note.
Nice. Well, my last one today is it's a beautiful book that I bought a couple of weeks ago. It's called Rule Britannia, When British Sports Cars Saved a Nation. And, you know, we talk about cars a lot on the show. You know, I've got an old Land Rover, old British vehicle, and I've always had this sort of love of old British sports cars. And so this book was an easy hook for me when I first kind of heard about it. It's a slightly oversized kind of coffee table style art book with a lot of just beautiful original photography in it. Kind of the basic structure of the book is a brief introduction, followed by kind of big chapters about kind of each of the big British car manufacturers, the big sports car makers of the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s.
For sure.
AC, Aston Martin, Austin Healey, MG, Mini, Triumph, Jag, etc. And it's a very deep dive. It's a very dense look at each brand, to the point where I might have sort of gleaned over some of it because it was a little more information than I wanted. But if you're into that stuff, if you really nerd out on the ins and outs of who owned the company and why they changed ownership and what the strategy was for this type of brakes and et cetera, this is the book for you. But if you're someone who just likes gorgeous studio photography of the most beautiful, in my opinion, beautiful old roadsters and sports cars, it's also just a spectacular book. And the color is the slip cover is just this beautiful, of course, British racing green with just a simple Jag XK on the cover, I think XK 120,
lovely.
With a simple title, just beautiful minimalist design. Beautifully produced. And the book, Petrolicious, I think, sells it in their store, but their shipping's a bit high. I found it on Amazon. It's about an $89 book. So for a book of that quality, it's not unreasonably expensive. It's certainly up there. Check it out. It's gorgeous. It is. It's a really, really, really worthwhile book. So check that out. And that's what I got for the week.
Okay, so I think that's the show. And as always, thanks so much for listening. Hit the show notes for more details. You can follow us on Instagram at Jason Heaton and at J.E. Stacy. And you can follow the show at The Greynado. Big thanks to Hodinkee for supporting the show. And definitely go back and start listening to past episodes of Hodinkee Radio. There's some really fascinating guests there, and it's an entirely different format than TGN. If you have any questions for us, concerns, whatever, please write thegreynado@gmail.com, and please subscribe and review wherever you find your podcasts. Music throughout is Siesta by Jazzar via the Free Music Archive.
And we leave you with this quote from the explorer David Livingstone, who said, "I will go anywhere, provided it be forward."